Please turn your Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 6. You know, Caleb and I had no communication about what my sermon would be about this evening, but the song he led in a lot of ways is very appropriate. A lot of the ideas, I guess technically the opposite of a lot of ideas, we'll be speaking about tonight. The refrain, do you think about what you're saying as you say these things? We are claiming these statements to be true for ourselves. The refrain is probably one of the most powerful statements of faith we can make. Speaking to God, it says, "You alone are my strength." We trust in Him for our strength. "You alone are my shield." We trust in Him for our protection, only Him. "You alone will my spirit yield." We only submit to God. Those are some big statements. "You alone are my heart's desire." We desire Him most of all, above other things, as if we only desire Him. "And we long to worship You." Man, that's a sermon in and of itself. Now, I'm not going to try to say that's a sermon this evening, but what I want to talk about is perhaps one of the most universal things that tries to compete with God and take that place in our lives. It's money. If you turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6, we're going to read two verses that are very familiar and often quoted incorrectly. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, Paul warns Timothy to warn the church in Ephesus, "Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that many have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." Now, I was familiar, with what this verse said. Not from church, but I heard it a lot as a child in media. And people would say it, they would say, "Money is the root of all evil." You ever hear that phrase before? Yeah. Now, that's in some ways similar to what Paul's saying, but Paul doesn't say money is the root of all evil. He says the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. That's still pretty bad, but that's very different at the same time. The reason why I'm bringing this out before we get to talking about the love of money specifically is it's really easy to make overstatements about things like this, and then anything you do say that's true, you lose the audience. Money in and of itself is not bad. Paul tells Timothy in the same book later, or same chapter actually, in verses 17 and 18, he says, "As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, and to be generous and ready to share." Paul doesn't tell the rich to be poor, but rather, use your riches in a way that honors God, share them, so don't hold on tightly, don't be greedy, don't lustfully and greedily seek more, but be willing to share and do good. There's a proverb that talks about the righteous store up an inheritance for their children. Now, a lot of people say that's talking about spiritual inheritances, but the thing is about proverbs, there's enough proverbs that say that. I think it just means what it says. It's good to leave an inheritance for your kids. So money's not bad. The love of it leads to all sorts of evils. Also, money's not the root of all evil. I think sometimes I've seen this happen, where people kind of compartmentalize their sin. "Well, I have sin, but I'm not like a greedy billionaire, so I'm not as bad as those bad rich people." Well, yeah, there's a lot of bad rich people. It's bad to be a greedy billionaire. But, you know, sin is sin. Arrogance, that's a root of all sorts of evil. Lust is a root of all sorts of evil. And the love of money, like those things, is also a root of all sorts of evil. So I want to talk about that tonight. Now, my goal is to not say that the love of money is not a serious threat. In fact, Jesus, as serious as Paul is in his warning against money and the desire to be rich, Jesus is even more serious. If you turn to Matthew chapter 6, Jesus doesn't just say it's dangerous. He basically says if you love money, you cannot love God. You cannot serve God. It's not even a risk. Straight up, it doesn't work. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, Jesus says, "No one can serve two masters, for he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Jesus is very binary about this. And it's interesting because there's a lot of things in this world that you can love as well as love God. In fact, there's a lot of things in this world you need to love as well as love God. For example, do we need to love our brethren? Yes. John writes in 1 John, if you don't love your brethren, you don't love God. Whoever hates his brother does not have God. So you can love God and love your brethren. Can you love your family and love God? Yes, we're commanded to. Now, we need to love God more, don't get me wrong, but we not only can love God as well as our family, but we need to. Can you love your neighbor and love God? Yeah. Once again, we need to love God more, but those two loves need to coexist. In this case here, this love cannot coexist. I think that's really interesting. You cannot serve God and serve money. You might try, and I think a lot of Americans do try, but you can't. You will either love one or hate the other, or be devoted to one and despise another. You can only give your heart to one of those two things. And while I was thinking about this passage, I was wondering why. Jesus doesn't say why, but for our sermon this evening, I want to talk about one reason why I think this is true. I think this is true because money tries to compete with God as the role of provider. God is to be, as we sang in that song, our strength. He's to be our joy, our shield, our protection, and he provides our freedom. You know what money tries to offer us? Those same things. And you know why it's so tempting to put money in the place of God? Because money actually can, to a limited degree, do those things. We use money. It's valuable because it's valuable. Yes. If there was something more valuable than money and better at being money, that's what we would use at money. You want to go to the store and buy something? Use money. You want to buy a house? Use money. It's very hard to find somebody who doesn't want to trade you something for money. That's why we go to work, for money. In Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28, Paul tells the thief to no longer steal, but work and give. Well, you know what he's going to earn while he's working to share with others? Money. The purpose of currency is to exchange for other things. It's used to acquire things. You use it to provide. And because it's so good at it, it can be tempting to put your trust in it. So I want to talk about three ways that we are tempted to love money and put it in the place of God. First, I'm going to look at money as the source of our provider of joy and pleasure. Turn to James chapter 4. I can't believe I said money is valuable because it's valuable. It's true, I guess. So I want to start with James chapter 4 because not only is it just a really good example of how ugly greed is, it can tell us where greed comes from and how that ugliness shows its face. Because once again, when I think about somebody who loves money, people here don't come to mind. I think of, once again, the greedy billionaire who's making children in Africa work for pennies by the hour so he can take what the shoes are making and sell them for $80 here. When I think of somebody who loves money, I think of like Scrooge McDuck, you know? You guys ever read the Scrooge McDuck comics, how he had that big old money bank and he'd swim in it? But it's not just people like that who love money. The audience here is materialistic and loves the world. And I think we can learn a lot from that. In James chapter 1, verse 1, it says, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Did I say 1? I mean chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 1. Sorry. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So James doesn't outright say they love money, and if somebody wanted to argue about that, I wouldn't really argue. I think it's fair to say they're materialistic and worldly, if you'd let me have that. And materialism and loving money, I mean, they're twins. So grant me that, please. So their greedy behavior's ugly. Now, I don't think, at least I hope not, in verse 2, I don't think they're literally murdering each other. I could be wrong, but I think he's using this as a figure of speech. They're wanting to murder each other. They're being nasty. They're acting out of line. And when we see this, it's really easy to say, that's bad. But as far as I know, nobody here is acting like that right now. I don't see myself acting like that right now. So it's kind of hard to see the application. Yeah, these people are really bad. What does this have to do with me? Well, first of all, these people are Christians. It's not just the unbelieving billionaires on Wall Street who love money. These Christians in the book of James have a big materialistic problem. We see that in chapter 2 with them favoring the rich, and then he condemns the rich later in chapter 5. These people really had the wrong priorities. They really loved wealth and the world. But also, I think it's worth pointing out, they weren't acting ugly just because they were greedy. Look at verse 2. The thing I like about James is he's very, like, to the point and practical. He, like, spells out how this process worked. They desire and do not have. So it's not just the desire, it's the desire and the lack of fulfillment of that desire. So what do when they can't get what they want? They murder. They covet, so they're being jealous, and then they cannot obtain. So once again, there's a strong desire and then the lack of its fulfillment. So then how do they react? They fight and quarrel. You know how you tell the difference between a well-trained kid and a spoiled kid? It's not by giving them what they want. If you have a spoiled child and a well-trained child, and you both give them what they want, they're going to act similar. Not inseparable. You could probably tell the difference as parents better than me, but they will act similar. It's really easy to be content when you have what you want. You know how you tell which one is spoiled? You take away what they want, and then the spoiled child becomes very evident. That's what happens to these Christians here. It's not just simply they were greedy. They were greedy and couldn't have their desires met. You know, adults are a lot like children. It's really easy to be content and be happy and have a good attitude when everything's going your way. But our hearts and where our treasure is revealed when what we want is taken away from us. Now, don't get me wrong. I, before I started preaching, worked in the workforce as a furniture maker, and even though I worked for my dad, not only have I been threatened with being laid off, I have been laid off before. So I know what it's like to have your source of financial security taken away. It's scary. But the difference is, where is our treasure? Where is our trust? What does Jesus promise us in Matthew chapter 6? I think verse 30 or 31. Seek first the kingdom of heaven, and all you need will be provided to you. For the Christian, losing money is very frustrating, maybe scary, but it's not the end of the world. To the person who loves money or loves the world, it's time to get violent when you take their money. You know, that's why money is such a big part of politics. One really big way to make sure people vote for you is to tell everybody that the other guy's trying to take their money away. That's a really powerful tactic for a reason. For people who love money, that's the last thing you want to have happen. So I really like this passage because suddenly it becomes a lot more applicable. Everything might be fine now, but how do I act when my physical possessions, my money, my insurance, my investments, what happens when they dry up? How do I react? That gives a big indicator of what kind of heart I have. And see, this is why I wanted to talk about this topic, because this, as Americans, we are so blessed. I mean, the poorest among us have air conditioning, refrigerators, multiple sets of $100 electronics. We have access to vehicles if we can't drive ourselves. We are so blessed. Very rarely in our country do people come and say, confess Christ and lose your bank account. Sometimes we go through hard times financially, don't get me wrong. But what happens when somebody in this congregation goes through a hard time financially? They get help. And that's a blessing. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. But it's maybe not always a blessing that our heart never gets tested. So that's why I want to talk about this, because it's a very insidious sin. Just kind of like pride and arrogance is a quiet sin that we're often blind to our own pride. I think the love of money can be quite, we can be quite blind to it too. Look at Proverbs chapter 10. So, another way we love money is by trusting in it as our source of security. In Proverbs chapter 10, verse 15, Solomon writes, "A rich man's wealth is his strong city. The poverty of the poor is their ruin." You know, when I first read that proverb, it kind of shocked me a bit. Solomon is straight up saying it's better to be rich than it is poor. And I think he's right. There is some benefits to having financial security. There just are. There are benefits to wealth. If you are below what you need to live, there's temptations for desperation. There's temptations for compromise. You're in need to rely on other people who may or may not be reliable. It's a dangerous position to be poor. Be poor and alone, that's a bad combination. There's value in being rich. He's acknowledging that. And that's why it's so tempting to trust in riches, because it's not like they don't actually make a difference. See, the big difference between the security that God provides and the security that money provides is, like many of the things money does, the gratification is instant. So if you want security and you can afford it, you can buy bodyguards. That's instant. Praying to God and asking him to keep you safe, well, you don't know how that's going to turn out. He might preserve your body, or like he does for James in Acts chapter 12, he preserved his soul. Peter got let out of prison. He protected Peter physically. James died but went to heaven. With money, you find the person, they name their price, you pay them, you get that thing. That's why it's so tempting. It takes faith to appreciate and enjoy the security that comes from God. The things that money brings, that's instant. And it's very tempting. But it's not perfect. In Proverbs chapter 18, Solomon, who also wrote Proverbs 10:15, elaborates more. I wish chapter 18:11 was actually chapter 10:16. It'd help a lot if it was. But God knew what he was doing when he wrote the scriptures. In Proverbs 18, verse 11, it says, "A rich man's wealth is his strong city, and like a high wall in his imagination." So it can provide you some wealth. Wealth can provide you some security, but a lot of the security it provides is just in your head. Both are true. It is better to be rich if you can choose than to be poor. But also, the security wealth provides can be fleeting. For example, if you are so wealthy, you know what you become? A target. Not just a target for violent thieves and robbers. Also, everybody who wants to bum money finds you very attractive. But it is a target for robbers. You know what houses robbers are least likely to go into? The houses in trailer parks that have a bunch of junk outside the house and have a couple busted windows, they figure it's already been looted. But also, more importantly, the security wealth provides does not provide any sort of spiritual security. Turn to Luke chapter 12. Because that's a security that matters. I'm speaking positively about money, not because I think you need to trust in money. My point is the opposite. But I'm pointing out how desirable money is for good reason, because that's the enemy we're up against. If I went up to you and said money has no value, you'd look at me like I had two or three heads. It does have tempting value. It does. And especially when you look at it through the eyes of the world. So we need to understand what it is capable of and see that there's still more. So in Luke chapter 12, verse 13, Jesus tells a parable. And I've always kind of wondered what to do with this parable, but I feel like I have a better understanding of it now. So in Luke chapter 12, 13 through 21, it says, "Someone in the crowd said to him," that being Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for you for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." Now, I've heard people, when they read this is an example of what I think is going too far, to almost, like, they won't outright say it, but subtly preach against, like, saving and investing. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true at all. Jesus doesn't say, so this is people who are rich and lays up treasure for themselves. He says that and is not rich towards God. It's not the wealth that's the problem. It's the storing up wealth for themselves on earth while not having wealth in heaven. The sin wasn't in what he did, it's in what he didn't do. And you see that in the text. This man is very selfish and very materialistic. So he has an abundance of crops. Where's the prayer of thanksgiving? Where's the desire to offer a grain offering? Where's the thoughts about the poor or the needy or the blind or the lame? None. Who is he thinking about the whole time? Himself. And he kind of prays to himself, the person is so selfish. And he's not just praying to himself. He's kind of planning on praying to himself. I'm going to take all this stuff for me, and then I'm going to thank me, and very much all about himself. You know what else I think is interesting about this guy? It doesn't seem like he's called a fool because he's an adulterer. It's not like he went and he robbed his neighbors to get his wealth. He didn't, like, cheat on his taxes either. He's a good citizen, hardworking guy, just trying to provide for himself and, I guess, his family if he had one. He's just trying to be a very responsible and financially wise, which I think is good. If you guys didn't know, my second favorite way of helping people, other than teaching them the Bible, is teaching them financial literacy. So I'm not saying it's bad to be financially wise, but that's all he was. He wasn't spiritually wise. He didn't use his wealth to help others, and that's the sin. He was rich towards himself, but not towards God. And I think this is such a quiet spiritual killer, because he wasn't a bad guy. He worked hard. He earned what he had. Why should he feel as if he did anything wrong? I'm afraid there's a lot of Christians, I hope I'm wrong, on the Day of Judgment Day, whom God is going to call fools. They lived in America. They never had to choose their wealth before God. So they did the minimum. They went to church on Sunday. They had the Lord's Supper. But rarely did they spend time with their brethren. Rarely did they invest in the kingdom. Rarely did they talk, if any, to their friends in the community. They went to church. They were faithful to their spouse. They didn't break any laws. And they were hard workers. They worked really hard to build their wealth. But they weren't invested in the kingdom. They were invested in everything else except the kingdom of God. And Jesus calls those people fools. Well, God on the Day of Judgment calls them fools. You know, in some ways, if we face persecution in this country and you had to choose between your retirement and Christ, we wouldn't have that much of a problem. Because the people who were doing that, they'd have to choose your money or God. But that doesn't happen. So you know what it takes? A lot of honesty. Where am I investing my resources and my time? Where is my treasure? Where do I go to feel safe? When this guy was seeking safety, seeking consolation to his soul, he looked to his big barns, or at least to his plans for big barns. That's what made him feel safe. Where do you go when you need to feel safe? Do you open up your bank account to make sure it's still all there? Do you look out at your property to see all that you have? There's people who do that. I'm not joking. Or do we go to God in prayer and remember what he did for us? Where does our soul go when we're looking for our safety and security? Turn to Proverbs chapter 22, verse 7. Another reason why we might love money is when we trust in it as our source of freedom. And I think this is particularly a big snare for young people. There's a movement going on among millennials called the FIRE movement. It's financial independence and retire early. It should be early retirement, but they wanted to make it sound cool. And it's a big movement where you basically work 80 hours a week, do nothing else, save as much money as you can so you can retire and live the lifestyle you want for the rest of your life. It's a really big movement among my peers. It's kind of messed up that none of them have attained it as far as I know. So they basically did all the hard work without even any of the reward. That's another snare of wealth or the desire of it. But anyway, in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 7, Solomon writes, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is a slave of the lender." There is freedom in having money. If you have a mortgage, you need to work. You need to make sure you get that monthly payment, because if your mortgage goes into forbearance for too long, well, that's what we call evictions. That's what they're for. And you lose your house. If you borrow a lot of money for a car, you need to work and make sure it gets paid off. Otherwise, the repo man's going to come and take that nice car away. There is an obligation we have when we have great amounts of debt, even a little amount of debt. There is freedom in having wealth and not debt. I'm not trying to preach wealth and prosperity. That's the opposite of my sermon. I'm just saying money does provide freedom. Also, in chapter 19, verse 4, Solomon writes, "Wealth brings many new friends, but a poor man is deserted by his friend." Once again, one good way to accrue favor with people in the world is to be rich. You know, it's kind of interesting what different jobs and demographics throughout history become popular or desirable. I was listening to a celebrity chef talk about when he first started working as a chef, when he would like go on dates and he'd tell girls what he did, that he was a cook, they'd laugh at him. Now he has a TV show and a Michelin star restaurant. But you know what demographic has never, unless you're a communist, had trouble being popular? Being rich. Very few people, except once again communists, despise the rich. So there is value in having wealth. You want to make opportunities for yourself? Add a bunch of zeros in your bank account. But that's not the most important freedom we can have. There's a far more important freedom, and that's in John chapter 8. Jesus tells us here about a freedom that's available to anyone, no matter your background, your race, your economic situation, the language you speak. Jesus says in John chapter 8, verse 31, "So Jesus said to the Jews who believed in him, 'If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' They answered him, 'We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say we will become free?' Jesus answered them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know you are the offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I've seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father." This is such an interesting passage. It's one you guys are familiar with, but it shows us the nature of the freedom Jesus provides and the nature of the blindingness of worldliness, if that's a word. Jesus says to them, "If you abide in my word, you will be my disciples, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." You know, money can buy you all sorts of books, but it can't buy you wisdom. You know, Bibles nowadays are relatively cheap. They don't cost much. But how many people spend thousands of dollars to go travel around the world to find themselves or to find the truth in some sort of spiritual journey, when the truth is relatively available? You go to a dollar store, you can find a Bible. I think they even sell them at the local 7-Eleven at Biglerville, too. They sell Bibles everywhere. And the cool thing about Jesus' freedom is it doesn't matter where you are, you're free. For Paul, when he was in prison in Philippi, he might have been a prisoner, but guess what? He was free. Paul was more free than the people who had put him in prison. Isn't that interesting? And think about all the things he was free from. He was free from worrying about what might happen to him. He writes in Philippians that if he stays, he'll serve and he'll help the brethren. But guess what happens if he dies? He gains because he goes to Christ. He's free from the lies of the world. He's free from the dog-eat-dog fight of the world. He doesn't have to worry about competition. There's in Philippians chapter 1, Paul talks about how there's people preaching Christ to make him jealous. You know how free Paul is? When Paul hears about that, he's happy. You know, for a worldly person who's materialistic and in love with money, when you have coworkers undermining you and trying to make you jealous, that ruins your day. I remember at the cabinet shop, I feel like half the time, well, 80% of the time, the guys were competing over promotions that were never going to happen. But just the thought that somebody might get a job and position over them, they were constantly undermining each other. And that's probably why the promotions never happened, because they were so good at undermining each other. Christians are freed from that. Our success is not measured by the title on our business card or the zeros in our bank account. We're free to be happy and just enjoy the blessings God gave us. Most importantly, Paul is free from sin. Even if you have all the money in the world to do whatever you want, if you are in sin, you are still a slave. Because guess what? You're not, whether you're a free in God or a slave of sin, you're not ever doing really what you want. You're either doing the will of God or the schemes of your flesh and the devil. You're a slave. Money can't buy you freedom from that. In fact, the love of money puts you enslaved to that. So you trick yourself because I have opportunities that you're free, but you're really not. I think the response of the Jews demonstrates that blindness. In John 8, verse 33, after Jesus says, "The truth will make you free," they say to him, "We are offspring of Abraham, and we've never been enslaved to anyone." Now, they're definitely not, they can't be talking about their history because they have been enslaved multiple times as the Jews. But this doesn't even make sense if they're talking about their present. They're currently occupied by Rome, and they're not in chains, but they can't do whatever they want. They're at the whims of the Romans right now. But even though their statement is disconnected from reality, I think they actually believe it. I think that's the worst part. That's the worst part of the enslavement of the world, of money, and of worldliness. The lies you believe, you actually believe. You are blind. That's why the truth is so valuable. You are not enslaved to the lies that the world tells you. You're not enslaved to the lies of the devil. In verse 38, Jesus says, "I speak of what I've seen with my Father, and you do what you've heard of your father." And then they're confused. And then Jesus later on says in verse 44, "You are of your father, the devil." What's the point of having all the wealth in the world if Satan is your benefactor? There's a reason why in the world the idea of selling your soul to the devil is never a good idea. It's kind of interesting. That's an example of blindness. The whole world understands it's bad to sell your soul to the devil, but then people sell their souls to the devil because of the love of money, yet they know it's wrong to do. Talk about a blind irony. So our question is for tonight, who is your master going to be? Is it going to be God, or is it going to be money? You know, maybe the changes might be very subtle. Maybe nobody will tell the changes. Maybe you change how you comfort yourself. Maybe you change how you react when you're scared. Maybe you might need to speak to your family about how you guys operate the household. But whatever it is, if there's any changes you need to make, you can come forward and we're happy to help you as we sing the song of invitation.